This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. A few dozen friends of mine gave me a wonderful Christmas present. They each recorded some Christmas stories for me to broadcast. These run the gamut from spiritual to funny, from touching to shocking to scary. We've got some sci-fi, we've got some poetry, there are some songs and some jokes. Robin Bullock supplied the instrumental music. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
This is Jerry McKee reading A Cup of Christmas Tea by Tom Haig. The log was in the fireplace, all spiced and set to burn. At last the yearly Christmas race was in the clubhouse turn. The cards were in the mail, all the gifts beneath the tree, and 30 days reprieve till Visa could catch up with me. And though smug satisfaction seemed the order of the day, something still was nagging me and would not go away. A week before, I got a letter from my old great-aunt. It read, "Of course I'll understand completely if you can't, but if you find you have some time, how wonderful if we could have a little chat and share a cup of Christmas tea." She'd had a mild stroke that year, which crippled her left side. Though housebound now, my folks had said it hadn't hurt her pride. They said, "She'd love to see you. What a nice thing it would be for you to go and maybe have a cup of Christmas tea." But boy, I didn't want to go. Oh, what a bitter pill to see an old relation and how far she'd gone downhill. I remembered her as vigorous, as funny, and as bright. I remembered Christmas Eves when she regaled us half the night. I didn't want to risk all that. I didn't want the pain. I didn't need to be depressed. I didn't need the strain. And what about my brother? Why not him? She's his aunt, too. I thought I had it justified. But then, before I knew the reasons not to go I so painstakingly had built were cracking wide and crumbling in an acid rain of guilt. I put on boots and gloves and cap, shame stinging every pore. And armed with squeegee, sand, and map, I went out my front door. I drove in from the suburbs to the older side of town. The pastels of the newer homes gave way to gray and brown. I had that disembodied feeling as the car pulled up and stopped beside the wooden house that held the Christmas cup. How I got up to her door, I really couldn't tell. I watched my hand rise up and press the button of the bell. I waited, aided by my nervous rocking to and fro, and just as I was thinking I should turn around and go, I heard the rattle of the china in the hutch against the wall. The triple beat of 2 feet and a crutch came down the hall, the clicking of the door latch and the sliding of the bolt, and a little swollen struggle popped it open with a jolt. She stood there, pale and tiny, looking fragile as an egg. I forced myself from staring at the brace that held her leg, and though her thick bifocals seemed to crack and spread her eyes, their milky and refracted depths lit up with young surprise. "Come in, come in!" She laughed the words. She took me by the hand, and all my fears dissolved away as if by her command. We went inside, and then, before I knew how to react, before my eyes and ears and nose was Christmas past, alive, intact. The scent of candied oranges, of cinnamon and pine, the antique wooden soldiers in their military line, the porcelain nativity I had always loved so much, the Dresden and the crystal I'd been told I mustn't touch. My spirit fairly bolted, like a child out of class, and danced among the ornaments of calico and glass. Like magic, I was 6 again, deep in a Christmas spell, steeped in the million memories the girl inside knew well. And here, among old Christmas cards so lovingly displayed, a special place of honor for the ones we kids had made, And there, beside her rocking chair, the center of it all, my great aunt stood and said, "How nice it was I'd come to call." I sat and rattled on about the weather and the flu. She listened very patiently, then smiled and said, "What's new?" Thoughts and words began to flow. I started making sense. I lost the phony breeziness I use when I get tense. She was still passionately interested in everything I did. She was positive, encouraging, like when I was a kid. Simple generalities still sent her into fits. She demanded the specifics, the particulars, the bits. We talked about the limitations that she'd had to face. She spoke with utter candor and with humor and good grace. Then, defying the reality of crutch and straightened knee, on wings of hospitality she flew to brew the tea. I sat alone with feelings that I hadn't felt in years. I looked around at Christmas through a thick, hot blur of tears, and the candles and the holly she'd arranged on every shelf, the impossibly good cookies she still, somehow, baked herself. But these rich, tactile memories became quite pale and thin when measured by the Christmas my great-aunt kept deep within. Her body halved and nearly spent, but my great-aunt was whole. I saw a Christmas miracle, the triumph of a soul. The triple beat of 2 feet and a crutch came down the hall, the rattle of the china in the hutch against the wall. She poured 2 cups, she smiled, and then she handed one to me, and then we settled back and had a cup of Christmas tea.
The Rescue, written by Cleveland Amory, read by Sherry Thrasher. To anyone who has ever been owned by a cat, it will come as no surprise that there are all sorts of things about your cat you will never, as long as you live, forget. Not the least of these is your first sight of him or her. That my first sight of mine, however, would ever be memorable seemed, at the time, highly improbable. For one thing, I could hardly see him at all. It was snowing, and he was standing some distance from me in New York City, in an alley. For another thing, what I did see of him was extremely unprepossessing. He was thin, and he was dirty, and he was hurt. The irony is that everything around him, except him, was beautiful. It was Christmas Eve, and although no one outside of New York would believe it on a bet or a Bible, New York City can, when it puts its mind to it, be beautiful. And that Christmas Eve, some years ago, was one of those times. The snow was an important part of it. Not just the snow, but the fact that it was still snowing. And it is supposed to be, but rarely does over Christmas. And the snow was beginning to blanket, as at last it does at first, a multitude of such everyday New York sins as dirt and noise and smells and potholes. Combined with this, the Christmas trees and lights and decorations inside the windows, all of which can often seem so ordinary in so many other places, seemed, in New York City that night, with the snow outside, just right. I'm not going so far as to say that New York that night was a little town of Bethlehem, but it was at least something different from the kind of New York Christmases best exemplified by a famous Christmas card sent out by a New York garage that year to all of its customers. "Merry Christmas from the boys at the garage," that card said. "Second notice." For all that, it was hardly going to be, for me, a Merry Christmas. I am no Scrooge, but I am a curmudgeon. And the word Merry is not in the vocabulary of any self-respecting curmudgeon you would care to meet, on Christmas or any other day. You would be better off with a New York cab driver, or even a Yankee fan. There were other reasons why that particular Christmas had little chance to be one of my favorites. The fact that it was after 7 o'clock, and that I was still at my desk, spoke for itself. The Anti-Cruelty Society, which I had founded a few years before, was suffering growing pains. Frankly, it is still suffering them. But at that particular time, they were close to terminal. We were heavily involved in virtually every field of animal work, and although we were doing so on bare subsistence, salaries, or no salary at all for most of us, the society itself was barely subsiding. It had achieved some successes, but its major accomplishments were still in the future. and so, to put it mildly, was coin of the realm. Even its name, the Fund for Animals, had turned out to be a disappointment. I had in what I had thought of as a moment of high inspiration chosen it because I was certain that it would, just by its mention, indicate we could use money. The name had, however, turned out not only to not do the job, but to do just the opposite. Everybody thought that we already had the money. Besides the fund's executor being low and Christmas Eve, so was my own. My writing career, by which I had supported myself since before you were born, was far from booming. I was spending so much time getting the fund off the ground that I was 4 years behind on a book deadline and so many months behind on 2 magazine articles that, having run out of all reasonable excuses, one of the things I had meant to do that day was to borrow a line from a late Dorothy Parker and tell the editor I had really tried to finish, but someone had taken the pencil. As for my personal life, that too left something to be desired. Recently divorced, I was living in a small apartment, and although I was hardly a hermit, I had a goodly choice of both office parties and even friends' parties to go to that evening. Still, this was not going to be what Christmas is supposed to be. Christmas is, after all, not a business holiday or a friend's holiday. It's a family holiday, and my family at that point consisted of one beloved daughter who lived in Pittsburgh and had a perfectly good family of her own. On top of it all, there was a final irony in the situation. Although I had had animals in my life as far back as I could remember, and indeed had had them throughout my marriage, and although I was working on animal problems every day of my life, I had not a single creature to call my own. For an animal person, an animal-less home is not home at all. Furthermore, mine, I was sure, was fated to remain that way. I traveled on an average of more than 2 weeks a month, and was always away from home almost as much as I was there. For me, an animal made even less sense than a wife. You do not, after all, have to walk a wife. I had just turned from the pleasant task of watching the snow outside to the unpleasant one of surveying the bills when the doorbell rang. If there had been anyone else to answer it, I would have told them to say to whoever it was that we already gave it home, but there was no one, so I went myself. The caller was a snow-covered woman whom I recognized as Ruth Dwork. I had seen Miss Dwork for many years. A former schoolteacher, she is one of those people who, in every city, make the animal world go round. She's a rescuer and feeder of everything from dogs to pigeons, and in a lifetime soldier, it's what I have called the army of the kind. She is, however, no private soldier in that army. She makes it to go around. In fact, I always called her Sergeant Dwork. "Merry Christmas, Sergeant," I said. "What can I do for you?" She was all business. "Where's Marion?" she asked. "I need her." Marion Propes, my longtime and long-suffering assistant, is an experienced rescuer, and I knew Mrs. Dwork had, by the very look of her, a rescue in progress. "Marion's gone," I told her. "She left about 5:30, saying something about some people having Christmas Eve off." I told her she was a clock watcher, but it didn't do any good. Sergeant Dwork was unamused. "Well, what about Leah?" she demanded. Leah Albo is a national coordinator for the Fund of Animals and an extremely expert rescuer. She, however, had left before Marion, too. What else? Another rescue. Miss Dwork was obviously unhappy about being down to me. "Well," she said, looking me over critically but trying to make the best of a bad bargain, "I need someone with long arms. Get your coat." As I walked up the street with Sergeant Dwork, through the snow and biting cold, she explained that she had been trying to rescue a particular stray for almost a month, but that she had had no successes. She had, she said, tried everything. She had attempted to lure the cat into a have-a-heart trap, but, hungry as he was, and successful as this method had been in countless other cases, it had not worked with this cat. He had simply refused to enter any enclosure that he could not find his way out of. Lately, she confessed, she had abandoned such subtleties for a more direct approach, and although she had managed to get the cat to come close to the rail fence at the end of the alley, and even to take bite-sized chunks of cheese from her outstretched fingers, she had never been able to get him to come quite close enough so that she could catch him. When she tried, he would jump away, and then she had to start all over the each time ever more difficult task of trying again to win his trust. However, the very night before, Sergeant Dwork informed me she had come the closest she had ever come to capturing the cat. That time, she said, as he devoured the cheese, he had not jumped away but had stood there just as he was, nearer than he had ever been, but still maddeningly just out of reach. Good as this news was, the bad news was that Mrs. Dwork now felt that she was operating against a deadline. The cat had been staying in the basement of the apartment building, but the superintendent of the building had now received orders to get rid of it before Christmas or face the consequences. And now the other workers in the building, following their super's orders, had joined in the war against the cat. Mrs. Dwork herself had seen someone, on her very last visit, throw something at him and hit him. When we arrived at our destination, there were two alleyways. "He's in one or the other," Sergeant Dwork whispered. "You take that one, I'll take this." She disappeared to my left, and I stood there, hunched in my coat with the snow falling, peering into the shaft of darkness and having, frankly, very little confidence in the whole plan. The alley was a knife cut between two tall buildings filled with dim, dilapidated garbage cans, mounds of snow open refuse, and a forbidding grate. And then, as I strained my eyes to see where, amongst all this dismal debris, the cat might be hiding, one of the mounds of refuge suddenly moved. It stretched and shivered and turned to regard me. I had found the cat. As I said, that first sight was hardly memorable. He looked less like a real cat than like the ghost of a cat. Indeed, etched as he was against the whiteness of the snow all around him, he was so thin that he would have looked completely ghost-like, had it not been for how pathetically dirty he was. He was so dirty, in fact, that it was impossible even to guess as to what color he might have originally been. When cats, even stray cats, allow themselves to get like that, it is usually a sign that they have given up. This cat, however, had not. He had not even, though, besides being dirty, he was wet and cold, and he was hungry. And on top of everything else, you could tell by the kind of off-kilter way he was standing that his little body was severely hurt. There was something very wrong, either with one of his back legs or perhaps with one of his hips. As for his mouth, that seemed strangely crooked, and he seemed to have a large cut across it. But as I said, he had not given up. Indeed, difficult as it must have been for him with that off-kilter position, he proceeded, while continuing to stare at me unwaveringly, to lift a front paw. And snow or no snow, to lick it. Then the other front paw. And when they had been attended to, the cat began the far more difficult feat of hoisting up, despite whatever it was that was amiss with his hips, first one back paw and then the other. Finally, after finishing, he did what seemed to me completely incredible. He performed an all four paw, ears laid back, straight up leap. It looked to me as if he was, all of the things in such a situation, practicing his pounce. An odd image came to my mind, something, more years ago than I care to remember, that my first college tennis coach had drilled into our team about playing three-set matches. In the third set, he used to say, "extra effort for ordinary result." He was convinced that this unwanted display would inform our opponents that we were fairly bursting with energy, whether that was indeed the fact or not. We did the jumping, of course, because we had to, but all of us were also convinced that we were the only players who had ever had to do such a silly thing. Now when I see, without exception, every top tennis player in the world bouncing like cork into the third set, I feel like a pioneer and very much better about the whole thing. And when I saw the cat doing his jumping, I felt better too, but this time, of course, about him. Maybe he was not as badly hurt as at first I had thought. In a moment, I noticed Sergeant Dwork moving quietly. She had rejoined me. "Look at his mouth," she whispered. "I told you they have declared war on him." Ours was to be a war, too. But one not against, but for the cat. As Sergeant Dwork quietly imparted her little battle plan, I had the uneasy feeling that she obviously regarded me as a raw recruit, and also that she was trying to keep my duties simple enough so that even a mere male could perform them. In any case, still whispering, she told me she would approach the fence with the cheese cubes, with which the cat, by now thoroughly familiar, in her outstretched hand, and that during this period I apparently should be crouching down behind her, but nonetheless moving forward with her. Then, when she had gotten the cat to come as close as he would, she would step swiftly aside, and I, having already thrust my arms above her through the vertical bars of the fence, was to drop to my knees and grab. The sergeant was convinced that the cat was so hungry that, at the crucial moment, he would lose enough of his wariness to go for the bait and the bite, which would seal his capture. Slowly, with our eyes focused on our objective, we moved out and over the top. And just as we did so, indeed as I was crouching into position behind Sergeant Dwork, I got for the first time a good look at the cat's eyes peering at us. They were the first beautiful thing I ever noticed about him. They were soft and lovely and a radiant green. As Sergeant Dwork went forward, she kept talking reassuringly to the cat. meanwhile pointingly removing the familiar cheese from her pocket and making sure he would be concentrating on it rather than the large something looming behind her. She did her job so well that we actually reached our battle station at almost the exact moment when the cat, still proceeding towards us, albeit increasingly wearily, was close enough to take his bite from the sergeant's outstretched hand. That first bite, however, offered us no chance of success. In one single, incredibly quick but fluid motion, the cat grabbed the cheese, wolfed it down, and sprang back. Our second attempt resulted in exactly the same thing. Again the leap, the grab, the wolf, and the backward scoot. He was simply too adept at the game of eat and run. By this time I was thoroughly convinced that nothing would come of the sergeant's plan, but I was equally convinced that we had somehow to get that cat. I wanted to get over that fence and go for him. The sergeant, of course, would have none of such foolhardiness, and irritated as this made me, I knew she was right. I could never have caught the cat that way. The sergeant was, however, thinking of something else. Wordlessly, she gave me the sign of how she was going to modify her tactics. This time she would offer the cat not one but two cubes of cheese, one in each of her two outstretched hands. By this time she indicated, although she would push her right hand as far as it would go through the fence, she would keep her left hand well back. She obviously hoped that the cat would this time attempt both bites before the retreat. Once more we went over the top, literally in my case because I had already had my hands through the fence, over the sergeant. And this time, just as she had hoped, the cat not only took the first bite, but also went for the second one. And at that moment, as he was mid-bite, Sergeant Dork slid to one side, and I dropped to my knees. As my knees hit the ground, my face hit the gate. But I did not even feel it, for in between my hands, my fingers underneath, and my thumbs firmly on top, was Cat. I had him. Surprised and furious, he first hissed, then screamed, and finally, spinning off the ground to midair, raked both my hands with his claws. Again I felt nothing, because by then I was totally engrossed in a dual performance, not letting go of him and yet somehow managing to maneuver his skinny, desperately squirming body, still in my tight grasp, albeit for that split second, in just one hand, through the narrow apertures of the rail fence. And now his thinness was all-important because, skin and bones as he was, I was able to pull him between the bars. Still on my knees, I raised him up and tried to tuck him inside my coat. But in this maneuver, I was either overconfident or under alert, because somewhere between the raising and the tucking, still spitting fire, he got in one final rake of my face and neck. It was a good one. As I struggled to my feet, Sergeant Dork was clasping her hands in pleasure and obviously felt the time had come to rescue me. "Oh," she said, "oh dear, your face, oh my." Standing there in the snow, she tried to mop me with her handkerchief. As she did so, I could feel the cat's little heart racing with fear as he struggled to get loose underneath my coat, but it was to no avail. I had him firmly corralled, and once again with both hands. The sergeant had now finished her mopping and become all sergeant again. "I'll take him now," she said, advancing towards me. Involuntarily, I took a step backwards. "No, no, that's all right," I assured her. "I'll take him to my apartment." "The sergeant would have none of this." "Oh, no," she exclaimed. "Why, my apartment is very close." "So is mine," I replied, moving the cat even farther into the depths of my coat. "Really, it's no trouble at all, and anyway, it'll just be for tonight. Tomorrow we'll decide, what to do with him." Sergeant Dork looked at me doubtfully as I started to move away. "Well, then," she said, "I'll call you first thing in the morning." She waved a mittened hand. "Merry Christmas," she said. I wished her the same, but I couldn't wave back. Joe, the doorman at my apartment building, was unhappy about my looks. "Mr. Armory," he exclaimed, "what happened to your face? Are you all right?" I told him that not only was I all right, he ought to have seen the other guy. As he took me to the elevator, he was obviously curious about both the apparent fact that I had no hands and also the suspicious bulge inside my coat. Like all good New York City doormen, Joe is the soul of discretion, at least from tenant to tenant, but he has a bump of curiosity which would rival Mount Everest. He is also, however, a very good animal man, and he had had a good idea of whatever I had, it was something alive. Leaning his head toward my coat, he attempted to reach in. "Let me pet it," he said. "No," I told him firmly, "mustn't touch." "What is it?" he asked. "Don't tell anyone," I said. "But it's a saber-toothed tiger." "Underclawed, too. Wow," he said, and then, just before the elevator took off, he told me that Marion was already upstairs. I had figured that Marion would be there, My brother and his wife were coming over for a drink before we all went out to a party, and Marion, knowing that I would probably be late, had arrived to admit them and hold, so to speak, the fort. I kicked at the apartment door. When Marion opened it, I blurted out the story of Sergeant Dork and the rescue. She, too, wanted to know what had happened to my face and if I was all right. I tried the same joke I had tried on Joe, but Marion is a hard woman on old jokes. "The only other guy I'm interested in," she said, "is in your coat." I bent down to release my prize, giving him a last hug to let him know that everything was now fine. Neither Marion nor I saw anything. All we saw before his paws hit the ground was a dirty tan blur, which, crooked hips notwithstanding, literally flew around the apartment, seemingly a couple of feet off the ground, and all the time looking frantically for an exit. In the living room I had a modest Christmas tree. Granted, it was not a very big tree. He was not, at that time, a very big cat. Granted, too, that this tree had a respectable pile of gaily wrapped packages around the base, and even an animal figure attached to the top. Granted, even, that it was festooned with lights which, at rhythmic intervals, flashed on and off. To any cat, however, a tree is a tree, and this tree, crazed as he was no exception. With one bound, he cleared the boxes, flashed up through the branches, the lights, and the light cord, and managed, somewhere near the top, to disappear again. "Now that's a good cat," I heard myself stupidly saying. "You don't have to be frightened. Nothing bad is going to happen to you here." Walking toward the tree, I reached for where I thought he would be next, but it was no use. With one bound, he vanished down the far side, and, flashing by my flailing arms, tried to climb up to the inside of the fireplace. Fortunately, the flue was closed, thus effectively foiling his attempt at doing a Santa Claus in reverse. When he reappeared noticeably dirtier than before, I was waiting for him. "Good boy," I crooned, trying to sound my most reasonable. But it was of no use. He was gone again, this time on rapid rampage through the bedroom, one which was in fact so rapid that not only was it better heard than seen, but also during the worst of it, both Mary and I were terrified that he might try to go through the window. When he finally materialized again in the hall, even he looked somewhat discouraged. Maybe, I thought desperately, I could reason with him now. Slowly I backed into the living room to get a piece of cheese from the hors d'oeuvre tray. This I was sure would inform him that he was among friends and of no harm, and it would not befall him. Stepping back into the hall, I found Marion looking baffled. "He's gone," she said. "Gone," I said. "Gone where?" She shook her head, and I suddenly realized, for the first time in some time, there was no noise. There was no scurrying. There was no sound of any kind. There was, in fact, no cat. We waited for a possible reappearance. When none was forthcoming, obviously we had no alternative but to start a systematic search. It is a comparatively small apartment, and there are, or so Mary and I at first believed, relatively few hiding places. We were wrong. For one thing, there was a wall-long bookshelf in the living room, and this we could not overlook, for the cat was so thin and so fast that it was eminently feasible that he had found a way to clamber up and wedge himself behind a stack of books on almost any shelf. Book by book we began opening holes, but he was not there. Indeed, he was not anywhere. We turned out three closets, we moved the bed, we rustled the sofa away from the wall, we looked under the tables, we canvassed the kitchen, and here, although it is such a small kitchen, there it can barely accommodate two normal-sized adults at the same time, we opened every cupboard, shoved back the stove, peeked into the microwave, and even poked about in the tiny space under the sink. At that moment the doorbell rang. Mary and I looked at each other. It had to be my brother and his wife, Mary. My brother is one of only three men who went into World War II as a private and came out as a colonel in command of a combat division. He was, as a matter of fact, in the amphibious engineers and made some 14 opposed landings against the Japanese. He had also since served as a deputy director of the CIA, a man obviously used to crises. He took one look at the disarray of the apartment. In such a situation, my brother-in-law doesn't talk, he barks. "Burglars," he barked. It looked like a thorough job. I explained to him briefly what was going on, and that the cat had now disappeared altogether. Not surprisingly, while Mary sat down, my brother immediately assumed command. He demanded to know where we had not looked. "Only where he couldn't possibly go," I explained, trying to hold my ground. "I don't want theories," he barked. "Where haven't you looked?" Lamely, I named the very top shelves of the closet, the inside of the oven, and the dishwasher. "Right," he snapped, and advanced on the first of the closets, then the oven, and last the dishwasher. And sure enough, at the bottom of the ladder, actually curled around the machinery and wedged into the most impossible place to get into the entire apartment, was the cat. Ha! Said my brother, attempting to bend down and reach him. I grabbed him from behind. I was not going to have my brother trust his luck with one more opposed landing. Bravely, I took his place. I was, after all, more expendable. Actually, the fact was that none of us could get him out, and he was so far down in the machinery, even he couldn't get himself out. Do you use it? My brother demanded. I shook my head. Dismantle it, he barked once more. Obediently, I searched for screwdriver, pliers, and hammer, and although I am not much of a mantler, I considered myself second to no one, not even my brother, as a dismantler. My progress, however, dissatisfied my brother. He brushed me aside and went over the top himself. I made no protest. With the dishwasher, the amphibious engineer was, after all, at least close to being in his element. When my brother had finished the job, all of us, Mary included, peered down at the cat. And for the first time since my first sight of him in the alley, he peered back. He was so exhausted that he made no attempt to move, although he was now free to do so. I would like to make a motion, Marion said quietly, a move that we leave him right where he is, put out some food and water and a litter pan for him, and leave him be. What he needs now is peace and quiet. The motion carried. We left out 3 bowls of water, of milk, and of food, turned out all the lights, including the Christmas lights, and left him. That night when I got home, I tiptoed into the apartment. The 3 bowls were just where we'd left them, and every one of them was empty. There was, however, no cat. But this time I initiated no search. I simply refilled the dishes and went to bed. With the help of a sergeant, a colonel, and Marion, I now had, for better or for worse, for a few days at least, a Christmas cat.
Good evening. My name is Karen Rains, and I'll be reading a selection from Chicken Soup for the Cat and Dog Lover's Soul, entitled A Gift Exchange. My favorite Christmas custom is placing reminders of special people or events on my tree. It's only a tiny artificial tree, but it's loaded with mementos. Many were never intended to be ornaments. Intricately whorled cross-sections of pink seashells from Florida, several small hand-carved olive wood crosses from my trip to the Holy Land, a few traditional ornaments such as a deep blue hand-blown ball well over a century old given to me by an adopted aunt bring to mind people I love. 2 antique stars are family heirlooms. But the ornament I saved to put on last, most honored at the very top, came to me in a most unusual way. It started late one autumn, a chilly evening in 1980 when I got home from work. I happened to glance up at the crooked old apple tree next to the apartment garage, and a squirrel caught my eye. His patchy coat looked unhealthy and his tail downright bedraggled. He looked hungry as well as sick. I watched as he climbed the tree, but he couldn't climb very fast. I felt sorry for him. He looked as forlorn as an old bachelor with no one to love or look after him. I went inside and found an old sack of pecans. Then I placed one on the open cement porch, went back inside, and peeked between the red and white checked door curtains. Come on down, old batch, I thought. But the squirrel stayed in the tree. I was too tired and hungry to keep vigil, so I fixed supper and forgot about the nut. Next morning it was gone, and I put another in its place before leaving for work. That evening it was gone too, so I put out a couple more. This became a daily ritual, even though I seldom saw old Batch. About a week later, I was surprised to be welcomed home by the cautious old squirrel, who approached to within 3 feet of me on the sidewalk, obviously ready to back off if I made even one wrong move. I spoke softly and slowly climbed the steps. I'm glad you can use the nuts, I said. Let me get another one. When I returned with it, I stooped to place it in the accustomed spot. Then I went inside, gently closing the glass dorm door. Old Batch could see me, but he must have known I could not get near him. I waited excitedly, hoping to watch him eat this time. Sure enough, the aging squirrel hopped up my steps. but old Batch ignored my nut. Instead, he inched his way to the brick planter next to the porch, hopped in, rummaged around, and quickly pulled out a whitened fragment of bone from his hiding place beneath the dead leaves. Holding it in his paws, he seemed to be using it as a tool, as if he was sharpening his teeth. His bright eyes watched me all the while. Then he dropped the bone and picked up the nut. He held it near his mouth, but made no attempt to crack it with his teeth. Dropping the nut, he hopped down my steps one by one, turned and cocked his head, and waited on the sidewalk. His silent message came through loud and clear. This old squirrel was too decrepit to crack hard old shells without breaking his teeth. He must still be hungry. I found my nutcracker, cracked three nuts, and slowly opened the door. I placed the meal on the porch and retreated. Back in a flash, old Batch ate two nuts, nibbling away as he held each one in his tiny paws. He took the third nut with him. From then on, I put out only cracked nuts, several at a time. I continued to put cracked pecans out till mid-January, when the nuts went untouched. I never saw old Batch again, but he left behind vivid memories and something else. The day after I began cracking the pecans in exactly the spot where I had left them, I found a glittering, many-faceted, amber glass bead, about half an inch long. I wondered where the mysterious gem had come from. Maybe old Batch had scavenged it from a trash sack, or picked it up after someone dropped it in the alley. Had he held it in his tiny paws, turning his treasure around as the sun sparkled on it? I like to believe that he left it just for me, as his only way of thanking me for understanding his need. I was so moved that I sent the bead to a Florida cousin, a jeweler, who created a metal holder for my trinket. I carefully sewed it in the center of a miniature white star made of starched, hand-crocheted lace, and at Christmas time, the squirrel's sparkly gift is always the topmost ornament on my memory tree. For me, it is a beautiful reminder that I must never take for granted all the incomprehensible wonders of nature, or forget that even the apparently voiceless can communicate very clearly if we pay attention when they feel moved to say, "God bless you." That is by Mary Beecher Fisher. Merry Christmas.
This Christmas story is titled Christmas on the River by Billy C. Clark, as read by Eric Benrood. Winter had come to the riverbanks. The air was cool and sharp, and the rivers were beautiful. There were thin layers of ice along the edges of the rivers, and the leaves that had missed the current had been captured by the ice, and the meager sun shone and turned the leaves many colors. Now and then a brown ball would fall from a giant sycamore tree and break through the ice, and the water would bubble out and run in small streams across the surface. One day, as I was sitting on the river bank, I heard a group of boys coming through the willows. Christmas was only a few days off. At the church, the boys said, sacks of hard candy would be given out to all the young people. Anyone who wanted a sack could have it. All you had to do was to walk inside the church and get it. As I watched the splinters of river ice, I thought of only of the tall sacks of hard rock candy that they had talked about. To them, the candy might not have meant much, but to me it was something that cost more than I ever hoped to earn. During the next few days, all I thought about was the sack of candy. I watched the river, silent now and with a little current. I thought of walking inside the church and getting my sack of candy as quickly as possible, hurrying back inside the willow grove and working my way back to the creek. Of course, people inside the church would stare, but if I was fast on my feet, they wouldn't have long to stare. As Christmas Day came nearer,
I began to sneak to the top of the bank and measure with my eyes the distance from the giant maple to the door of the church. And the more I measured the distance, the farther it seemed to be. While I was inside the church, I would not have time to stop before I had picked up my sack of candy to thank God for it, but then I could do that easy enough when I reached the banks of the river again. Maybe, when I grew up and earned enough to buy good clothes and have my hair cut, I could go back inside the church and thank him proper. Christmas Day came at last to the valley. I was more scared than I'd ever been in my life. More scared than the day the ship, the Gordon C. Green, had slipped past as I swam across the Ohio River. At the mouth of Cattle Creek, I stopped and bent over the small stream and splashed the cold water against my face, and the wind dried it and cold pimples ran up and down my back. As I thought of walking inside the church, the bumps grew larger than the wind could make them. I hurried to the mouth of the Big Sandy and waited at the top of the bank behind the maple until I was sure that everyone was inside the church. I closed my eyes a moment and then ran out from behind the maple and didn't stop till I was at the door of the church. I stood for a minute to catch my breath and maneuvered around in front of the church as carefully as I would have moved around a snapper turtle. The door opened with a creak and I sneaked inside. At the far end of the room, a woman stood beside a large wooden table. On top of the table were white sacks. The woman at the table called out the name of a class, and a group of girls stood and walked single file down the aisle. As they passed by the table, they were each handed a sack. Then another name was called, and a group of boys, even smaller than myself, passed by the table, reaching for the sacks of candy that seemed so big they weighed the boys down. As I stood at the front end of the room, I became more scared than ever. All I could see were the tall white sacks of candy. Right now I was too scared to move, yet I had come much too far to turn back. I scanned the room for the boys that I had seen at the river. I waited until they stood and started down the aisle, and then I would fall behind them like a duck that belongs to the same flock. I kept my eyes peeled to the floor, never once looking up. The legs of the table came into sight, and I raised my head and stared into the eyes of the woman at the table. "This boy is not in my class," she said in a voice that seemed to shake the walls of the church. "Nor mine either," another woman answered from the first bench. "Nor mine," another voice said. "He doesn't belong here at all." Tears filled my eyes, and for a minute I was too scared to move. People were staring at me, and many of them shaking their heads. I knew now that all I wanted was to make it back to the rivers. This red brick church was not for me. I realized that I had been planning on getting something that did not belong to me. I turned and ran as fast as I could, down the steps of the church, and didn't even look back till I got to the creek. I splashed in and water circled my knees, and on the other side I fell to the sand and buried my head in my arms and cried. A short time ago, the sack of candy had meant almost as much to me as the two rivers. Now it meant nothing. Even if I had gotten it, I couldn't have taken it home. They would have thought that I had stolen it or begged it, which would have been worse. I stayed on the banks of the rivers below the house until the shadows crossed the water. Tears had frozen on my face, and where I had waded the creek, my legs were so cold they were numb. Then I heard footsteps on the frozen grass, and when I looked up, Mom was standing over me. She did not quarrel because I had stayed away from home so long without her knowing where I was. She knelt beside me, and I felt her arms around my shoulders. "Hush now," she said. "Time's come that even a man has to tell what's wrong. Tell me." And stuttering worse than a jaybird, I told her how I wanted to steal the sack of candy, expecting her to break a willow switch at any moment. But there were tears in her eyes, too, and she held me close. "Maybe it's better for our kind to give our thanks under the willows here. Prayers are far enough to climb without being hemmed in by the wall and the roof of an old building." "But," I said, "maybe God don't know that I'm down here. He didn't see me in the church, and I didn't see him." "Hush now with foolish talk," Mom said. "If he can see a little bird like a sparrow, you know that he can see a big boy like you." Mom pulled a handkerchief from her pocket and wet it over her tongue and wiped my face, and then the wind dried it. And that evening, Mom left the house and did not come back until after dark. I heard her come in during the night and pull the covers over us as she always did. But she stayed by our bed longer than usual this time. And the next morning when I woke, I felt something hard under my pillow, and when I reached down to find out what it was, I pulled out a small sack. and inside the sack was hard rock candy. I jumped from the bed and ran into the room where Mom and Dad had slept. I said, "Look, Mom, look, look what God has given us." "Upon my word," Mom said, "who'd have thought a prayer would have traveled that fast? Now, if you want to make the Lord happy, you'll share with the rest of the family." As I walked out of the room, I wondered why my brothers and sisters didn't ask the Lord for a sack of candy themselves. I sneaked a handful out of the sack and stuck it in my pocket so they wouldn't know how much the Lord had given me. I divided the rest with them, and then I ran down the river to eat what was in my pocket. When I reached the bank, I was so happy that I wanted to run and shout to both rivers. I looked into the clouds and thought of my prayer scaling the blue walls faster than a steam of smoke. But then, as I ran through the trees, I slipped over a stump and fell to the earth. The hard rock candy fell out of my pocket and rolled over the sand, picking up sand like a snowball scooping up snow. One by one, the pieces rolled down the steep bank and into the river. The Lord had seen me sneak the candy into my pocket back at the house. Mom was right. He didn't have any trouble at all seeing me here on earth.
Hello, I'm Pamela Smith. I'm going to be reading several stories from Chicken Soup for the Soul, the Book of Christmas Virtues. Our first tale is titled Music to My Ears, and it was written by Margaret Middleton. I sat silently in the back seat as we drove home from an evening church program where I'd heard once again the wondrous story of Jesus' birth. And my heart flooded with happiness as the three of us hummed to familiar Christmas carols drifting from the car radio. With my nose pressed against the side glass, I gawked at the department store displays. As we passed houses with lighted Christmas trees in the windows, I imagined the gifts piled under them. Holiday cheer was everywhere. My happiness lasted only until we came to the gravel road leading to our home. My father turned onto the dark country lane where the house sat 200 yards back. No welcoming lights greeted us. No Christmas tree glowed in the window. Gloom seeped into my 9-year-old heart. I couldn't help but wish for trees and presents like other children. But the year was 1939, and I was taught to be grateful for the clothes on my back and the shoes on my feet, to be thankful for a home, no matter how humble, and for the simple food to fill my growling belly. More than once I'd heard my folks say, "Christmas trees are a waste of money." I guess gifts must be, too. Although my parents had climbed out of the car and gone into the house, I lingered outside and sank down on the porch steps, dreading to lose the holiday joy I felt in town, wishing for Christmas at my house. When the late-night chill finally cut through my thin dress and sweater, I shuddered and I wrapped my arms around myself in a hug. Even the hot tears streaking down my cheeks couldn't warm me. And then I heard it, music and singing. I listened and looked up at the stars crowding the sky, shining more brightly than I had ever seen them. The singing surrounded me, uplifting me. After a time, I headed inside to listen to the radio where it was warm. But the living room was dark and still. How odd. I walked back out and listened again to the singing. Where was it coming from? Maybe the neighbor's radio? I padded down the long road, glorious music accompanying me all the way. But the neighbor's car was gone. And their house was quiet. Even their Christmas tree stood dark. The glorious music, however, it was as loud as ever, following me and echoing around me. Could it be coming from the other neighbor's house? Even at this distance, I could plainly see no one was there. Still, I covered the 300 yards separating their house and ours. But there was nothing and no one. Yet, to my ears, the ringing rang clear and pure. To my eyes, the night stars shone with such radiance that I wasn't afraid to walk home alone. Once I reached my house, I sat again on the porch steps and pondered this miracle. And it was a miracle, for I knew in my young heart and soul I was being serenaded by the angels. I was no longer cold and sad. Now I felt warm and happy inside and out. As I gazed upward into eternity, surrounded by the praise of heavenly hosts, I knew I had received a joyous Christmas gift after all, a gift straight from God, the gift of love, the shining star, and an everlasting Christmas. Continuing from the book of Christmas virtues, our next story is entitled Tending the Home Fires. It was written by Jim West. Our hard-working parents always did their best to provide memorial holidays for their family of seven. Weeks before Christmas, my father pulled double and even triple shifts at the cement mill to make sure there would be presents under the tree. Coated in ashes and soot, he'd drag into the house each night, bone-weary from cleaning out smokestacks. Besides one full-time job as city clerk and another one mothering us, Mom did all the things necessary back in the 1960s to make our budget stretch. Sewing clothes into the wee hours of the morning, mending hand-me-downs, packing school lunches, and laundering cloth diapers. Even so, my parents emphasized the memory-making moments, designing elaborate macaroni ornaments to decorate the tree, hanging dozens of cheery greeting cards from loved ones around our bedroom door frames, and singing carols as we hauled aging boxes of decorations from the basement to the living room. In mid-December, Mom gathered her baking sheets, her huge wooden rolling pin, and her kids spent an entire day in the cramped kitchen baking and decorating sugar cookies. And she always delegated one duty to me. Because our scant living room had no fireplace to hang stockings, we used a cardboard kit substitute. It was my job to assemble it each year, that special place where Santa would soon leave his few presents for us. Against one wall, I unfolded the fireplace front. Then I placed and balanced the black cardboard mantle that bore wounds from dozens of punctures where we thumbtacked our stockings during holidays past. After I inserted a red light bulb into the hole near the metal spinner, I plugged in the cord so the logs would burn. Satisfied at last, I settled to the floor in my favorite nook across from the fireplace, directly in front of a furnace vent. I knew the warm air blew from the basement, but in my mind, the heat spread from the cardboard logs to ignite my imagination. It was there that I spun my boyish dreams and lived my foolish fantasies. The years drifted on, and so did I. When all of us kids were grown and on our own, our parents hit the jackpot. I mean, really hit the jackpot in a big way. They won over $2 million in the Illinois State Lottery. As instant millionaires, the first thing they did was look for a new place to live. My father insisted on only two musts, an attached garage and a working fireplace. My mom wanted more space, and they found it. It was a beautiful two-story house with four bedrooms, a spacious kitchen, a dining area, a two-car garage, a roomy basement, and a living room with a working fireplace. In December, after their move, we all came home for our first holiday together in years. While everyone lazed and chatted by the fireside on Christmas Eve, I rose to my feet to stroll through the house on a private tour. Mom had decorated with recently purchased crystal ornaments and a hand-carved Santa from Germany. Embroidered holiday doilies graced new end tables, and expensive wrapping paper enveloped dozens of presents under the beautifully lit tree. From top to bottom, the place murmured, "New, gorgeous, tasteful." It certainly wasn't home as I remembered it. Near the stairwell, I glanced up. I did a double take, perched at the top, like a forgotten old friend I might bump into on the corner, stood the raggedy cardboard fireplace. With a smile as wide as Mom's rolling pin, I climbed the stairs and I sank to the top step as a wave of boyhood memories washed over me. Before long, Mom found me upstairs and stood silently at my side. I looked up, waiting for her eyes to meet mine. "You kept it, this old fireplace in your new home? Why?" After a long moment, she placed her hand on my shoulder and bent toward me. "Because I don't ever want any of us to forget the simple joys of Christmas," she whispered. And I nodded in understanding, pleased that I could still feel the warmth radiating from the old cardboard fireplace.